Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, my wonderful audience. It's always just a pickup to know I can just every week talk to you and just talk about all the things that are on my mind, all the great things that are going on out there in the world. And I've now created, it's up, it's running, my frequent alerts. It's right near the top of my website where you can sign up for getting from me frequent alerts on everything going on in the field that may be of interest to you. One of the things that I have up in my alert that it will connect you to is a new blog that I have up on Mad in America. Did you ever wonder about all this talk that, you know, yes, children on SSRIs, they have a doubling of the rate of their suicide. It's actually much bigger than that, but that's what the government comes up with. But not with adults. Well, you'll find out why by going to my frequent alert, and then if you want to learn more, just going right to the blog. And you'll learn about the upcoming conferences that alert you to that, and just anything else of interest that comes up. I'm just beginning them. Number three is up and running. I'm going to try to do them at least once a week. Something comes up more than once a week. My guest today is a really interesting human being, an accomplished human being, a person who does a lot of stuff out there. And her name is Kim Olver, O-L-V-E-R. She's got a social work, a master's degree, and a licensed counseling degree, and a bunch of other degrees, but she's a psychotherapist. And she is a psychotherapist who is executive director of the William Glasser Institute. Bill Glasser was a friend of mine. I didn't spend a lot of time with him, but we helped each other out and watched each other's backs and encouraged each other for many years. He came to my conferences. I went to his conferences. William Glasser. Choice Theory was one of his later books, and Choice Theory has become a lot of what Kim is about and that the Institute is about. And we have an upcoming conference with the Institute, and it's on July 6th through the 29th. Kim and I will talk more about it as we go on. But I'm co-sponsoring it, which means Kim does all the work, but they also keep all the funds. But I get to have some effect on the conference and to attach my name to it, which I'm delighted to do. And as a part of my contribution on July 26th, I'm going to do a full-day workshop with Bob Whitaker. I've invited Bob in for his first visit, I think, to the William Glasser Institute. So what could be better than on July 26th for some of you out there to spend a day, a whole day, with me and Bob Whitaker? Bob's going to give a talk and question and answer, and I'm going to give a talk and question and answer, and we're going to talk about anything you want to talk about eventually, because we're going to leave plenty of time for that. And then the conference goes on with all kinds of interesting people who are focused on choice theory, which is an extremely important approach to psychotherapy. It's a big component of what I do. I was emphasizing choice making today, partly from Bill's influence over the years. And at lunch on the July 27th, I'm going to give a talk again. So I think this is going to be a great conference. You can get to it by going to my website, since you're most familiar with that. Just look up at the top at upcoming events, up top at upcoming events, and you will right away my talk at Glasser 2, and it's in North Carolina, right, Kim?
Yes, it's in Raleigh, North Carolina.
To the right place. I got my tickets made and everything. So welcome, Kim, aboard. She's, by the way, she's an author. She's got a book out called, I love her title, Secrets of Happy Couples, Loving Yourself, Your Partner, and Your Life. I like that a lot. Her newest book is Choosing Me Now. That sounds narcissistic, but I'll bet it isn't. She's also doing training programs for certification for trainers. And you heard me talking a little bit about my hope for the future in that direction last week with marvelous Pam Popper, who was a partner of mine in a whole bunch of interesting and exciting activities. So I want to hear more from Kim Oliver about that. Kim, anything more about yourself you want to say? And otherwise, we can just start with your book, Choosing Me. I'm Choosing Me Now. I want to hear what it's about.
I'm happy to talk about that, and thank you so much. I'm really excited to have this opportunity to talk to you today and your audience, so I appreciate the invitation. And I'm really looking forward to the conference, because I've heard you speak at conferences before. I saw you with Dr. Glasser. You made quite an impression on me during that particular conference, and then I got to see you again in Florida. And we're just really excited to have you with us in Raleigh and with Bob as well. So I can't wait for that. But Choosing Me Now was a book that I wrote, the subtitle of which is Letting Go of What Doesn't Work to Make Room for What Does. And that book was really a way for me to try to understand something that was eluding me. I went through a period in my life, and Peter, you mentioned the many things that I do, and at one point, maybe 5 years ago, it seemed like everyone that I was running into was giving me the same message. And when things happen like that, I don't believe in coincidences, so I try to tune in and pay attention. And the message always was, what are you doing to take care of yourself? What are you doing to take care of yourself? And the answer was, I really don't know what I'm doing to take care of myself. I had so much going on. All I was doing was putting one foot in front of the other and doing the things that I needed to do. I wasn't really giving a lot of thought to what am I doing to take care of myself. And then I realized I knew that that was the right thing to do. Yes, yes, that makes sense. I need to take care of myself. But then the question arose, how do you do that? I'd never really spent any time really thinking about it. Now, of course, I know the physical things. You need to get enough rest. You need to eat well. You need to exercise. I mean, I knew those things. But surely there was more to taking care of yourself than just that. So I went back to what I know, which is choice theory, and Dr. Glasser proposes that we're all driven by five basic needs. And when you develop a relationship with anyone, you first have to get to know that person, and over time, if that person satisfies one or more of your basic needs, then they become a picture in what Glasser calls your quality world, which represents all the things that you want. So I thought, how do I become a picture in my own quality world? It has to work the same way. I need to get to know myself, and then I need to think about those basic needs and how can I meet those needs in a way that supports me and who I am. So that's what the book is really about. And it was exciting to me because it was almost like a workbook for me. As I was writing it, I was putting those ideas into practice because I needed to do it for myself first to know that it really worked. And then I felt it was okay to write about it. And so that's how the book came to be, and it's currently with the editor, so I expect it to be published in time for the Raleigh conference. So that'll be where it's first available.
Talk some more about the basic needs. Basic needs, I think needs theory in general is useful to think about what do we need, what do we desire, what are our goals. Talk about that some, would you?
Sure. So Dr. Glasser proposed that we are driven by five genetic needs, that we're born with these five needs, and we all have them, but we have them to different degrees. So of the five needs, one is survival. We have the need to survive, and along with that, there's some psychological aspects of survival, meaning to feel safe and secure. So there's survival, there's love and belonging, which is the need to be connected, accepted, appreciated. There's the need for power, which some people don't like to think of power because they think of power in negative ways, like I'm going to power over you, I'm going to bully you, I'm going to take what I want, I'm going to control you. And that is one way to get your power need met, but it's not what we would call a responsible way. So when I talk about power, I talk more about the need to be significant, the need to matter, the need to make a difference. We all have that need. Some of us have it stronger than others do, but we can all accept that we have the need to be significant. It's a little softer than using the word power. We have a need for freedom. And that's really the need to be able to choose our own path, the need for independence, the need to do what you want when you want without interference. We have a need for fun, and that need for fun is so obvious in children, and we're taught, you know, you get to have fun when your work is done. But then we get to be adults, and our work is never done. So many of us adults have put fun kind of in the recesses of our memory and forget that that's one of the needs that we have even as adults. So there's survival, love and belonging, power, freedom, and fun. And when we're getting the right amount of those needs met, then we feel good, we feel happy, we feel satisfied. But when we're not getting enough, and sometimes when we're getting more than we need, we can feel a little out of sorts. So choosing me now is really about thinking about those needs, how much you need, what are the ways you satisfy that, because, you know, those are the needs, but in order to satisfy the needs, you have to think about what you want. So some people might say, I need a husband or I need a wife. No, you don't need a husband or wife. You want a husband or wife. What you need is connection, love, belonging. You can get that from multiple places. You may say you need a car. No, you don't need a car. You want a car. What you need is power or freedom to be able to do the things that you want to do. So it's distinguishing between those wants and needs. And the things that drive us are really the wants, the quality world pictures. We wake up in the morning and we don't say, gee, I think I need some more freedom today. We wake up in the morning and we say, boy, I really want to do this today. And then we go about behaving in a way that we can get those things that we want. Hopefully in a responsible way so we're not hurting other people or causing other people to not be able to meet their needs while we meet ours.
One of the things that I find interesting and puzzling is to what extent do people have need for something they feel is meaningful that they're doing in their lives? I see a great variation in that. I mean, people like you and I and most of the guests, probably all the guests on my radio show, I'm sure all of them are motivated by a desire for a greater good, a desire for a meaningful influence on the world of some kind. And beyond, for example, family and raising children, which is among most meaningful things in the world, for many people the most, What's your take on that? And does Glasser talk about that? Do you talk about that much?
Yeah, I believe that that's wrapped up in the need for power, the need to have an impact, the need to make a difference, the need to matter. And some of us have a higher or stronger need for that. And so, you know, that could be satisfied if I were the leader of the of a street gang. It could be satisfied if I were the leader of a free world country. It could be satisfied by being a speaker like you and I are, who influence people's ways of thinking. It's really the way that we choose to get that need met is up to us, and it's also often related to the opportunities that present themselves to you. But if I have a strong need for power and I'm raised and surrounded by people who show me responsible ways of getting that met, like my dad was a business owner, so I had in my head that that's a possible thing. Of course I could have my own business. Maybe if your parent was in politics, you'd think about maybe I could run a country or, you know, a city or a state. But if you're born in an impoverished community, you may look around and think, well, the people with the power are the ones that are selling drugs on the street corner. Then that's what you're going to aspire to, because you want to have power. You need power, and you're going to be gravitate to those opportunities that you see in your life. So I think those of us who have power and we're able to get it met in a responsible and meaningful way, I believe we have a duty to pay back to people who may not have those means available to them, and provide mentoring and opportunities for people to see that there are other ways, and there are ways that can be even more need satisfying when you're actually helping others.
I'm with you 100% on that. And I think that that's really important, that we teach our children or allow our children to fulfill is this sense that they can have a meaningful impact or relationship to the world. I do think the word power is confusing, and I'm sure you get some of that.
Yeah.
I've not used that word myself. I think it's a confusing word, but I think it's true. We all do have that desire to have some power over the world, over our lives, over what goes on around us. I think it's a little confusing, but it's so interesting to try to parse all this stuff out, because, boy, it's really hard to describe and think about what human beings need and want. I hope your book does really, really well. Get me a copy when it comes out, please.
I'd be happy
to. When did you say it was coming out?
There'll be copies in Raleigh, so I'll give you your copy then.
Okay. So I won't get to see it. I'm gonna have Kim on again before Raleigh, so we can remind people about Raleigh and what that's all about. Anything else that you wanted to talk about in regard to the book? Are we done with the book?
Yeah, I think we are. I really think that the book is for people who are interested in getting to know themselves and develop a healthier relationship with themselves. I find Dr. Glasser talked a lot about relationship habits, and he helped us learn how to let go of some of those destructive relationship habits that we might use, the nagging and blaming and complaining and that kind of thing, and start using what he called the supportive or connecting relationship habits of listening, supporting, encouraging, respecting. You know, those kind of habits. And when I talk about who do you use those deadly relationship habits with the most, people will often say, oh, our loved ones, our children, or our spouses. And then when I say, I think there's one person you might use it with even more, and they all agree that they use them with themselves. And that does not help us have healthy relationships with ourselves. So that's who I wrote the book for. And hopefully if that speaks to you, you'll be able to find a copy when the book comes out. It should be on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So, choosing me now.
I like that a lot. I do think that, and I've never quite put it into words or heard it put into words before. I mean, in effect, you're saying that everything negative we do to other people, we also do to ourselves. So, and that fits, you know, we make people feel guilty, ashamed, and anxious, and by golly, we do it to ourselves.
Even more.
And we allow early influences to repeat it on ourselves. What were you going to say?
Oh, I just said we do it with ourselves even more than we do with other people. That's it.
Well, I think that depends on whether we have a tendency to be really manipulative, violent, and gaslighting toward other people.
Well, that's true.
But probably even those folks are doing it more to themselves than to other people as well, to get so alienated from themselves.
Right.
So that's a very good concept, folks. I think this is a worthwhile one to take away from this show is when you look at what you're doing bad to yourself, you're probably doing it to others. And when you look at what you're doing that's harmful to others, you're probably doing it to yourself. And life has a holistic quality to it about respect for oneself and others, love for oneself and others, supporting oneself and others. And the beauty to me of a loving relationship is that you're actually at times more focused on the other person's needs than your own, just as you are when you're a good parent to a young child. You're more focused on their needs much of the time, if not most, than your own. This is a critical issue where you have to save your own life to save theirs or something. But basically, mammals, including us, really do sacrifice for and put first often their offspring. And I think these are just really important things to think about. And that love is a matter, to a great extent, of being aware of your partner's needs as much or more than your own. And to me, that's how a loving relationship empowers people. Because we all forget about our needs, and if we have a loved one who's there to say, no, your needs, your desires, your wishes, your goals, your aspirations, don't let them go, and don't sacrifice them to me. Let's figure out a way how we can both have what we want. That makes sense?
Exactly, yes.
I think that whenever we talk, it always makes a lot of sense, because we both seem to think very alike, I think, about human beings and how they should live and relate to each other and take care of each other and so on. Well, one of the things that has always been a lifelong goal of mine, you've already accomplished, and that is developing training programs for people to help other people.
Yes.
So I want to learn from you today about what you're doing in that regard. And we've got lots of time, and I don't mind if it comes to that, spending the rest of the time on how do we teach other people and train other people and how can we certify other people to be good helpers, emotional helpers of some sort. Even the words for it are a struggle to find and to describe. So I'd love to hear from you all about your programs that you're working on in regard to training people, giving certificates and so on.
Okay, well, I'm happy to talk about that. So maybe what I would, I never even thought about this until you asked that question, but one of the things that I think the training programs that I use are built on is something that I did in college. And that was a long time ago, but I wanted to be a crisis worker on the hotline in town. And we were taught in, it was 80 hours, it was some crazy amount of time, where we had to go to training and we sat back to back because most of the work was done on phones. So we sat back to back so we wouldn't have any verbal cues, and we did role play for virtually 80 hours. And the idea was to be empathic. So we weren't looking to give advice. We were just looking to relate to the feeling that the other person was expressing. Whether or not they were labeling the feeling or not, we would listen to what they had to say, and then we would basically reflect, so you sound really angry about that. And then it would encourage the person to talk even more. But what that did for me was really help me become more empathic about other people's emotions and feelings, because I wasn't sitting there trying to think, okay, what's the next brilliant thing I'm supposed to say? I was just being trained to sit with and listen and hear that underlying emotion of the person I was working with. And if I got it wrong, it was no big tragedy, because the person would just correct you and say, no, I wasn't angry. I was really sad about it. And so, you know, that it was no harm, no foul. They just knew you were listening and you wanted to understand, so they felt okay to share what was really happening. So that was one thing that I think really impacted me. Then I went on to get certified in reality therapy and choice theory. So that was Glasser's program, and I had my bachelor's degree in psychology, and I was working at a foster care agency in Pennsylvania at the time. And they used reality therapy as their philosophical base in the way that they worked with the kids and the families. And I hadn't learned about reality therapy in college. That wasn't one of the theories that they taught. So I went through their training process, and it started with 4 days of training. And I got enough out of that training program to know that I really wanted to be certified in this. It was important. It gave me, I used to say a roadmap, now I'll say a GPS, about how to work with clients. And choice theory gave me kind of a foundation for when what I was doing wasn't working, I could go back to the theory. And I always knew another thing to try, because the theory, you know, really talks about never give up, and there's multiple ways of attacking a problem. So if one way isn't working, go back to the theory and just think about it from a different angle, and you'll see another way to try. And, you know, you just keep working at it until you find something that makes a difference. So I went on and I got certified. For me, it was a 5-year process. It didn't have to take that long, but that's how long it took me. And then once I got certified, then
How long would it usually take?
It would usually take about 1.5 years if you were just going straight through the whole process. It could be as short as 1 year. So there was a 4-day training, then there's a 6-month practicum. And during the practicum, you're just putting into practice the information you learned in the basic training. And then you take 4 days of an advanced training, and then you have an advanced practicum, which is, you know, more advanced application, more difficult clients, and also you're preparing for the final 4 days, which is actually the certification process, and you're demonstrating your abilities during certification so that you then receive this certificate that says you have completed your study in choice theory and reality therapy, and you get to put CTRTC after your name.
Now,
go ahead. I'm sorry, Peter.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to think about just what does this all require? Because my own thinking is that this should be done without any earlier educational requirements. Now, in regard to what was set up for certification in choice theory, did that involve you had to have a college degree or anything like that?
It did not require that, and I've got to tell you, as someone who has trained people, I sometimes say it's easier to train people who don't have the traditional psychology training, because the traditional psychology training spends a lot of time on history, what happened in the past, and as you know, Dr. Glasser is a big fan of you know, certainly recognizing the importance of the past and knowing that the past has contributed to who, greatly to who you are today. But that staying in the past or revisiting that painful past really does little to help with what you need to do right now today, which in Glasser's theory is improve your current relationships. So we don't spend a lot of time talking about the past, and that's not the typical psychology training. So I found sometimes it was easier to train people who didn't have a background in psychology because they didn't have habits that they had to unlearn. So we didn't have that requirement, and not everyone was taking the training to be a therapist. So choice theory is geared towards counselors, therapists, social workers, and educators. So teachers would take our training, school leaders, principals, superintendents. But also there were people who took it who were just looking for some self-growth and development. And the reason that it was, I think, such a long process and why the practicum was long is because most people believe in external control. Most people think that we have not only a right but a responsibility to make people do things that they don't want to do. And it requires some time to make that shift in your thinking from external control to internal control. And that's the biggest learning from becoming certified in choice theory. It's not just how can I work better with my clients. It's how can I be a better person? How can I stop trying to control the people around me and start supporting them in what they want to do and adjusting me when they're not doing what I want? So if I have someone in my life and I can say, boy, my life would be so much better if you would just whatever, fill in the blank with whatever you want, and they're not doing it. I've asked for it. I've told them what I want, and they're not doing it. My conclusion is what they're doing must be working for them. So if I care about that person, I need to accept that they have something that's working in their life. If it's not working for me, then I need to adjust me in some way so that I can either manage that going on in my life, or maybe I choose to care about that person from a distance. But I need to figure out how I'm going to manage if they're going to continue doing this thing that I don't particularly care for. And that requires some time to be able to make that shift. It took me, I'm going to say, it probably took me 14 years to really be able to say I do that almost all the time now. There's still obviously exceptions when I really wish somebody would do something that I want them to do, and I may get a little bit controlling in that area. But most recently, I remember having a conversation with my mother. And I was trying to help my mother to stop nagging her husband. And I realized in that moment that I was nagging my mother to try to get her to stop nagging her husband. So even though I've been studying this stuff for 30 years, I'm still not immune to sometimes using external control. But I try to recognize it early and stop quickly. But that's why it takes such a long time. And then of course,
one of the concepts that that I developed and to think about these things, exactly what you're talking about, and it's in my book, The Heart of Being Helpful. I don't know the last time I mentioned that book, and yet it's in some ways my most favorite book that I've written, The Heart of Being Helpful, which you can get on the website, you can get it on Amazon, is the concept of empathic self-transformation.
Yes.
Whereby being empathic with another human being, you change yourself to be the best you can be for that person. And that's not a sacrifice. It's just a natural process of when we care, then we shift some of whom we are. I mean, if a person is very vulnerable, and I happen to be a very direct and straightforward fellow, I think about that some more and about how to be with them. And if somebody is very direct and wants to relate that way, I may just find myself changing to relate that way, especially in therapy and when I'm doing therapy, in order to be as much in their ballpark, in their box as possible. empathic self-transformation. It's kind of a ugly, long word, but it's very similar to what I think to what you're talking about. Now, let me ask you more questions, and we're going to have time to get on to your certification program that you've developed, too. So in choice theory, you get the certificate, and then you are you at that point a competent counselor?
Well, no. And the only reason I say no is because being a counselor in the United States is regulated by the state where you live. So if you are...
No, I don't mean licensed. I mean competent. Are you somebody then who could, if they wanted to use the rubric trainer, could actually do therapy with people?
As long as they were operating within the guidelines, yes, I would say that they could.
So it's a psychotherapy training program, but you don't take responsibility for saying you're licensed to practice psychotherapy.
Correct, right. And I wouldn't say, you know, a teacher that takes our program would feel like they're ready to be a counselor, but they would be ready to have therapeutic conversations with their students. Reality therapy, I know it's called therapy, but really the process of reality therapy is a self-evaluation process where the helping professional is asking self-evaluation questions, almost Socratic questioning, if you will, of the helpee to try to help that person look at what they're actually doing and whether the actions that they're taking are going to lead them towards the thing that they're saying that they want. And I don't think you have to have, you know, a great degree or years of experience to be able to learn to ask those questions in a skillful way. And that's what the reality therapy training teaches people to do.
So just looking at the legal aspect of it, do you try to control, or did they? Are you still involved? Are you certifying people in choice therapy? Are you involved in that at all?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when a person's certified, do you attempt to monitor their behavior if they're really doing that?
No, we don't. We have a list on our website that says the list of people who have asked to be listed in our directory of people who have completed our training, but we have a disclaimer that, you know, we really can't vouch for the, you know, the skill level of the people or how well they're doing or how they're using it. We don't monitor that.
Good. Well, to me, that makes a lot of sense, actually. So your group could take these skills and use them in any way they wanted, and hopefully in lawful ways. If they're counselors, they could say, I'm a counselor and I'm certified.
Yes.
But if they're not a counselor, they could say, I'm a trainer. Is training becoming a legal status now in states?
Not that I'm aware of, but
I hope it never does. Yes. I don't know your view on that. But. So a person could say, I'm a trainer and I'm certified in this tech. Good.
Yeah, we tell people what they can say is, I'm Choice Theory Reality Therapy Certified. That's the acronym after their name, CTRTC. And then we have a training program for people to become trainers of the Institute. So once you're certified, if you want to train people in the certification of reality therapy and choice theory, then there's more training to take, different steps. There's three levels of trainer. And, you know, you take the first step and then you can facilitate the practicum. So you take the second step and you can be a basic instructor. And then the third step allows you to teach any of our programs. So.
Now, folks, my great audience, I know this is pretty nitty-gritty and down-to-earth, but I think this is so important because this is about something I think is critical to providing mental health-type services without having to pay somebody in New York City $500 or somebody in the outlying maybe a fifth of that. Because – this is a way that people, without having to go to medical school or getting a PhD or a PsyD or even a master's degree, can have a certificate for what they believe in and what they've been trained in, and can advertise as long as they don't imply they have a state licensure. And I think we just need tons more of this. We need competing therapies out there that people can come to understand and promote on their own and through organizations. And again, Kim, are you with me on that? Does that make sense to you?
Well, it really does make sense, and it leads me in the direction of coaching, which is the other program you wanted to talk about. So it's a really nice segue into that, because you may not be a licensed therapist, so you can't say, I'm a counselor, I'm a therapist, but there is a designation of helping professionals now called coaches. And as of right now, there is no regulation on the coaching field. And when I learned the difference that the National Board for Certified Counselors distinguishes between counseling and coaching, I realized that reality therapy is really a model of coaching instead of counseling. And so people who learn reality therapy, I think, make excellent coaches.
Do you know, you wouldn't know, but increasingly I tell my patients, my clients, I'm coaching, and especially with teenagers that I see them also, I have with their families, but I'll also see them individually if I'm working with their families too. Really believe that teenagers need to have their parents relating to them better when they come for help. But I tell them, I'm your coach. Don't worry about this being psychiatric treatment. In fact, in the future, just tell somebody you had some good coaching, hopefully good. And people like the idea that you're being coached rather than treated.
Right.
And this is so interesting. I've not had this conversation in any depth like this before, folks. Really, really with anybody about their training programs. And I'm just getting involved in this now. No sense of reinventing the wheel and not benefiting from what others are doing and saying. So tell us about the coaching. Now, it gets certified. You've gotten some sort of certification that's beyond yourself in this case. So tell
right.
us about that. What is that?
Well, it was really interesting. I think it was in 2011. It might have been 2010. The National Board for Certified Counselors said that if you are a certified counselor and you are offering coaching services to your clients, you needed to be a certified coach by graduating from one of their approved certified coaching programs. And so I was already doing coaching. I didn't have a certificate, but I had a business. My business is called Coaching for Excellence, and I do coaching now instead of counseling because I travel so much that I can't commit to being geographically in the same place week to week to week to see someone for counseling, and I don't provide any kind of emergency services. So coaching was a natural fit. I could be in Europe and coach a client in the U.S. I could be in Australia and be coaching someone from Europe. You know, it doesn't matter where I am geographically, because majority of coaching is done on the phone or on some video internet service like Skype or WhatsApp or something like that. So I switched over to being a coach, and when I got this mandate that now I have to be a certified coach through one of their certified coaching programs, I thought, well, why don't I create a certified coaching program? I know reality therapy, and I don't know, of course I am biased, but I don't know of a better method for coaching than reality therapy. So I created a program called the Academy of Choice, and it's based on Dr. Glasser's choice theory, and I teach reality therapy through the program, and it is one of the board-certified coach-approved programs. So what that means is you can take my program and you get a certificate from the Academy of Choice. So you can say, I'm a certified coach because you have a certificate from me. But if you want a world-recognized credential, you can take my program and then sit for the board-certified coach exam and pass that exam, and you can use the credential board-certified coach. And that's basically recognized worldwide. So it just gives a little credibility to the field of coaching, which I think is important. Because right now, you could drop out of high school and be a plumber for 10 years and then say, well, I think I want to be a coach now. And you can be a coach. But through the board-certified coaching program, there are some educational requirements and some
What sort of educational requirements? Oops. What are they?
Well, the first thing, in board-certified coaching, you have to have at least a bachelor's degree. You can't just come in with a high school degree or a GED. Now, there are other mm-hmm. programs where you can. If you don't have a bachelor's degree, you can go through the International Coach Federation, and they have some coaching programs that will work with people who don't have a college degree. But the board-certified coach program, I think, is very much geared towards professionals. So I offer the 30-hour program, which is for people who have a master's or PhD in counseling, or they're a national certified counselor, or they're a licensed counselor in their state. Then if you have those credentials, then you only need the 30-hour program. If you have another master's degree in a related helping professional field other than counseling, they're saying you need a 60-hour program, and I provide a 60-hour program. If you only have a bachelor's degree, then you can take their 120-hour program. I don't offer that yet at Academy of Choice, but there's other programs that do, and that's the work of the board-certified coach credential. And so my program can be taken online or it can be taken in person. My preference always is in person, but I'm from that generation where I think, you know, being face-to-face with someone is much more impactful. But you can take the 30-hour program totally at your own pace. Everything is pre-recorded and it's on the website, so you take it when you want to take it. You want to get on at 4 in the morning and do your work, you can. You can do it in 30 hours, or you can spread it out over 15 years if you want to. There's no time requirement. And you just need to get it finished and then take the board-certified coach exam. Do a little bit of coaching. I think they ask for 30 hours of coaching before you sit for the exam. And then when you pass, you get the board-certified coach credential.
Now, how well do you think your particular program would lend itself to what I'm interested in, which is more of the program that we talked about first, where you're basically teaching people and certifying them in choice theory and therapy, where you don't have all these structures and things built into them? How similar are the two programs, the two actual teaching experiences?
Well, I think that the certified coaching program presumes some basic skills. So mostly, if you're already a licensed therapist or you have a degree in counseling, I don't need to teach you how to counsel people. You know how to do that. Mainly what I need to do is teach you the difference between counseling and coaching and help you stay in your lane, because the ethics say that it's not okay to counsel and coach the same person. So even though I am both a counselor and a coach, if I'm seeing someone, I have to identify them as either my coaching client or my counseling client. And if I'm counseling someone and I think they need coaching, I'd have to refer them to someone else. So I think that a longer...
Yeah, this does get wound up in a kind of professionalism. Ugh. But I love what you're doing. It's really, I do love what you're doing. I would wish, wow. I mean, I'm doing counseling, coaching, and psychotherapy all the time in one bundle. Mm-hmm. Does the fact I'm a psychiatrist mean I can do anything I want?
It probably does. You're probably okay. I just know that they got really.
But I hate to see that going on where you, if you're doing coaching. I mean, what do you honestly think about that? Trying to separate coaching from counseling and saying they're two different animals. What's the purpose of it? How do you feel about it? I'm not meaning to put you too much on the spot.
No, I can answer that. I believe that if you are a reality therapist, you've been coaching all along. So it's been a little challenging for people who do reality therapy to understand how coaching is different, because it's not different from what they do. So the board-certified coaching people, this is what they say the difference is. When you're working, it's similar to what you said, Peter, when you talked about people like to say, I have a coach, as opposed to, I have a therapist. Because I have a coach means you already have basic skills, and your coach is helping you get better. So it's very strength-based. Whereas if you're seeing a therapist, and I know this is not always true because I know many therapists who don't work this way, but somebody's come to you and they have something wrong that you're trying to help them fix. It's different than somebody's coming to you and they're already competent and you're just helping them to get better at what they already know to do. So that's one of the distinctions. Another distinction.
So coaching assumes competency.
Right. The other distinction is counselors often focus on the past. They spend a lot of time talking about, you know, what happened in your childhood and your relationships with people. And coaching really deals with right now, today, and your goals for the future. The other thing is how the services are delivered. I already said most coaching is done by phone or the internet, whereas counseling is almost always done in person, although there are some distance coaching programs cropping up. And the other thing is insurance. So insurance doesn't pay for coaching. So coaching are self-pay, and counseling is usually referred to a third-party payer. And then the other thing is, let me think. Well, I had it in my mind and I lost it. Who's in charge of the session? So, in a counseling session, there's often a kind of a give and take between the client and the counselor about what direction things are going to go. In coaching, the client is completely in charge. The client says at the beginning of the session, "This is what I want to talk about today." And that's what you do. And you move forward with that. And the client decides how often they're going to see you. They decide the length of the session. They may say, gee, I only think I need 15 minutes today. Okay, fine. Or I think I only need to see you once a month. I don't need to come in once a week. That's terrific. Whatever you say is, you know, you're in charge. The client is in charge. So I'm not sure about separating counseling and coaching. They draw a line and say this is counseling, this is coaching, but I think it's a very blurry line. And I'm not sure what the reason is for why you couldn't do both with the same client. For years I did until this happened, and now I pretty much do exclusively coaching. And if I'm working with someone on coaching and I think they have some, you know, deep-rooted issues that they need to work out, I would refer them to a colleague that does counseling. And I might still work with
That's
them
mm-hmm.
as a coach.
Are you doing any counseling where you're working with people who, quote, have deeper rooted problems?
I'm not at this time, no.
Yeah. I think it's a kind of a carving up the field concept. I think it's part of that traditional, let's carve things up and own it and do this and that with it. Because I think it's entirely possible, for example, and I doubt you'll disagree, that the most disturbed people who come into the office might need coaching rather than what we call counseling.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
So, I mean, it really doesn't make a a lot of sense. Now, where does relationship fit into counseling and coaching? You and I both, I'm sure we agree again that relationship we have with people is awfully important to their growth and development. Is there any difference in the way relationship fits into coaching and counseling, the way people are talking about it?
Well, I do a lot of relationship coaching. And so to me, it's about, okay, you're in relationship with someone, you want that relationship to improve. Let's talk about some things you can do to improve that relationship. And I'm a firm believer that I don't have to have both people in the relationship in the room to be able to help a relationship. I can help you do better in your relationship. It's ideal, of course, when both people are there. But as a counselor, I often had one person dragging the other person in, saying, we need counseling. And the other person is like, I don't want to be here. I think we're okay. I don't know why you're unhappy. And so I can work with the unhappy person to help them be more satisfied in their relationship and to maybe do some things that will get them more of what they want from the relationship. I work with parents who are trying to have a better relationship with their child. And then we're not going into deep-seated, like, okay, so tell me what your relationship was like with your mother. And
how important is your relationship to them? I think the more distressed people are, the more important just having a relationship that's professional and has boundaries and therefore can be caring is very, very important. How much emphasis do you put on the relationship itself that you're creating?
Well, I would say there's more emphasis on the relationship when I'm doing counseling.
That's what I would think, yeah.
Yeah, not that I don't focus on relationship and coaching, but those people that come to me for coaching, they're highly motivated to make change. They're ready, they're reaching in their own pocket, and they're saying, I want to fix this. People that come for counseling are often very tentative, they're not sure, they don't trust as easily. Trust is really important. So I think a great portion of the work that I do in counseling is around that therapeutic relationship and maybe even being the first person in that person's life who has a professional, empathic, and non-judgmental relationship. Yeah. So it's a modeling, too. Yeah, I think it's more
important. Well, as always, Kim, we're drawing to a close too quickly.
Always.
Thank you. I mean, it's so good to hear you and share all this stuff with you. Kim Olver, O-L-V-E-R. Is there a way for people to get in touch with you? Do you want to give out an email address or anything like that, or just your website?
Well, sure. My email is kim@kimolver.com, K-I-M-O-L-V as in Victor, E-R, .com. My website is therelationshipcenter.biz. So center is spelled
The relationshipcenter.biz.
Correct.
All right, Kim. Come see me and Kim. The conference again is in July. It's what are those dates, Kim?
July
26th. 26th. You can hear me and Bob. But you can find out about it on the website. Me and Bob Whitaker will be there. All right, folks. Thanks for listening to a very, very interesting conversation. And I'll be with you again in a week, you great people. Thank you. Bye-bye, Kim.
Bye. Thank you.